Good evening, everyone. Good evening, everyone. This is Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. How are you all doing tonight? I'm understanding that last night there was some trouble with people being able to get through, and I was on the phone with them today, and I'm hoping that that all worked out. So if you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. If you are having trouble with long distance, we have, for a limited amount of time, a toll-free number, and that area code is 855-346-3351. 855-346-3351. Okay, so like literally maybe 15 minutes ago, I received an email that notified me that there's a new bill that was put forth, and it's put forth in the Senate and the Assembly, and it's bill number, you got that pen? A10071, and that's the same as S or Senate 07818. So it's Assembly Bill A10071 and Senate Bill S07818. I'm just learning about this as we are here now. There is the sponsor of the Senate bill, S07818, is Senator Young and co-sponsor Senator Gallivan. And the sponsor of the Assembly in rules is O'Donnell. And so the bill, reading from the Senate bill summary of S07818, it says, relates to treatment plans for certain inmates who are receiving mental health services at or prior to the time of their anticipated release date. And this is the same bill as A10771. If you'd like to call in and give your opinion about involuntary outpatient commitment or anything else for that matter, good, bad, ugly, area code 267-521-0167. So I guess tonight you'll get the special treat of hearing me try to figure out what exactly is going on here and what this bill is and how it relates. The email that I got was of a article that just came out in Capital, New York on June 13th, 2014 by Jessica Alemo. I hope I'm saying your name right. And the article was titled, Lawmakers Seek Involuntary Psych Commitment for Ex-Cons. The way people are able to talk about people is just really troublesome to me. So it says, Albany, two lawmakers have introduced a last-minute bill that would give parole officers the authority to start involuntary commitment proceedings for ex-cons with mental illnesses. The bill would also provide mental health discharge planning when inmates with mental illnesses are released from prison. Assemblyman Daniel O'Donnell and Senator Kathy Young introduced the bill after a mentally ill man was released from prison and was accused of stabbing two children in Brooklyn less than 2 weeks later. And this is horrifying. I mean, just, you know, so obviously it becomes, you know, nobody is advocating murder here or violence. And so the article continues, we cannot, this is a quote from O'Donnell. It says, we cannot let this happen again. This recent tragedy is only the freshest example of the dire consequences that result when both our mental health and criminal justice systems fail us. I firmly believe in restorative justice, but when a person is mentally ill and dangerous, the only viable option may be institutionalization, and local officers must be empowered to choose that option when necessary, O'Donnell said in the release. Alamo continues, Albany lawmakers have just four session days left. They will convene Monday through Thursday of next week. And so, you know, here's the big issue. If we don't jump in on what's going on in the prison industrial complex, then we've, in David Oakes's words, abdicated the whole thing. That we need to be speaking out about this and the fraud that's being perpetrated on society by thinking that psychiatry can control it. And it's not even about outpatient psychiatry. This article is saying the only viable option may be institutionalization. And so it's not even involuntary outpatient commitment. This is just straight up institutionalization, it seems. And so you're listening to me learn about this for the first time. If you'd like to jump in on the conversation, have some ideas about this or anything else, happy Saturday. You can call in at area code 267-521-0167. And the toll-free line is area code 855-346-3351. So I'm trying to get to where, I'm at the summary page, but I'm trying to get to where the full page is at, where it actually tells you what's in the bill, but I'm having some trouble getting there. For anybody who may be interested in looking along with me as you go ahead, it's assembly.state.ny.us /MEM/Daniel-J-O'Donnell/sponsor/. And it's, so it's all of the legislation on his page that he is sponsoring. So I'm trying, so it relates to, so A10071, and it's, well, let me see if I just click everything and see if I can get, there's the text. Okay, found the text. Maybe there's the memo. Okay, this is what I've been looking for. So the bill number A10071, the title of the bill is An Act to Amend the Correction Law and the Mental Hygiene Law in relation to treatment plans for certain inmates who are receiving mental health services at or prior to the time of their anticipated release date. Okay, see, that's not what it says in the article. What it says in the article is, when a person is mentally ill and dangerous, there, you know, all of a sudden you've got the sensationalized spin on how it is they put this kind of information out to people, and people don't realize what a control issue this can be. All right, I'm just going to read. Purpose. To provide mental health discharge planning for inmates who will be released on community supervision and to authorize regional community supervision directors to initiate involuntary commitment proceedings under the Mental Hygiene Law. Summary of provisions. Section 1 adds a new subdivision 4 to Section 404 of the Correction Law. Section 2 amends subdivision 4 of Section 9.27 of the Mental Hygiene Law. Section 3 provides an effective date. So, justification. On June 1st, not my just, this, again, I'm reading here. On June 1st, 2014, 9 days after being released from prison without mental health medications or any contact with a community mental health care provider, a mentally ill man stabbed 2 children in an elevator in Brooklyn, killing one of them, a 6-year-old boy. This is absolutely heinous and horrible, and nobody is justifying on any level any kind of action that this particular person took. The man's, I'm reading again, the man's parole officer informed her supervisors that she believed him to be dangerous and thought he should be sent to a mental hospital. All right, continual coupling of dangerousness and people who are psychiatrically assigned is terrible. While most mentally ill people are not violent, no inmate who receives mental health treatments while in prison should be released to the streets without a plan for continuity of care. People who have stabilized in prison should not destabilize in the community for lack of mental health care. The bill provides that inmates on the mental health caseload or who refuse services but are mentally ill receive mental health discharge planning and, if necessary, appointments with psychiatrists or other prescribing mental health professionals in the community to ensure that medication orders do not lapse and that the released individuals remain under appropriate medical supervision. Additionally, it is important that regional community supervision directors be authorized to act quickly and independently in situations in which their field officers believe a supervisee to be in need of hospitalization. Currently, parole officers can initiate petitions for assisted outpatient treatment under Kendra's law, but may not initiate a petition for involuntary commitment. This bill would clarify that the regional director of community supervision has standing to initiate such proceedings. Legislative history. This is a new bill. Fiscal implications, minimal. Yeah, right. Minimal fiscal implications, right. Local fiscal implications, none. Right. This act shall take effect 60 days after it shall have become law. And so that's where we're at. If you'd like to call in, area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. There are a couple of people online that I'm opening up your line if you'd like to speak. Because of the technicalities last night, I just want to make sure that there's not somebody who's trying to get through who can't. So of the people who are on the line, any of you like to say anything?
Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. What area code are you calling from?
This is 585.
Okay, great. 585, and I have a 917. If the person who's on a 917 line would like to join in the conversation, just let me know. 585, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Best ever, actually, Lauren. This is
Hi.
Your...
I didn't recognize.
And I'm at the Alliance Center in Utica.
Excellent. How is it?
Everything is okay here.
Fabulous. I hear there's going to be a little gathering of like-minded people in Utica in July prior to Bastille Day. Is that correct?
That's what I understand.
My understanding is it's July 11th and 12th and that we would be leaving on the 13th to go to Albany to sit vigil for 72 hours in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health. Is that right?
It sounds right to me. And the days of the week again, because the numbers and the days, I need both, I know, for myself to think about things.
It's right, because Bastille Day has not been over weekends now, and so now we're finally at weekdays, right?
Yes.
That's great.
So the gathering in Utica would most likely begin on what day of the week?
A Friday, I believe. July 11th in Utica?
It sounds like it.
And then we would be meeting and talking about ways that we would be able to organize and mobilize people into, planning for some type of direct response to all of these things.
That's the plan.
Yeah.
Nonviolent direct action. A couple days in Utica for some pre-planning and trying to get more people involved into the 72-hour time frame of the vigil. It's not that people need to be there for 72 hours, but there will be people there to talk and plan and share information and stuff during that time in Albany.
Well, I think that it's wonderful, and this will be the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day. Is that right, George?
Yes, the 34th annual Bastille Day event to celebrate the human spirit and break the silence about psychiatric oppression.
34 years, wow. That is amazing. That is amazing. So I don't know if you caught what I was talking about a moment ago about this, these new bills, Assembly and Senate bills that have come out.
I caught some of it with the prisoners' release. I read a little about it today. I didn't realize how bad it actually was until you read you read from it.
It's really bad.
Really bad.
And this thing about people who have people who don't want to comply or don't acknowledge that they have, anything wrong with them as being evidence for why they need to be institutionalized it's replicating out. And, and I'm guilty of this, and I feel bad about this because one of the things that I always say is, that you're doing this to people who have committed no crimes, that they've done nothing wrong. And instead of, eliminating the idea that this is a human rights violation regardless of what is happening, they're now moving into expanding it to reach out to people who are incarcerated. And for any reason, right? Because the prison
you wouldn't be incarcerated unless you were mentally ill, because, you would have to be mentally ill to commit any type of crime, right?
Right, and then you have the warden from Cook County Jail explaining that, some of the reason that people are in jail is because they were on trespassing charges because they were trying to sleep someplace. And so, the idea that psychiatry is going to fix economics is ludicrous, and that all of these people are, you never know what's going on. And in 2014, what is legal or illegal needs to be seriously reconsidered, as many states are reconsidering it. And that it targets people who are struggling economically, who are oppressed, who are people of color. How much more disproportionate, how much more targeted can it be?
Anyone that's vulnerable in any way is who are targeted.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And then, I've been speaking to some people, and that just because you have money doesn't exclude you from it is one of the messages that I'm keeping on hearing from people to remind people. But this is anybody, and everybody is at risk. And if they're going directly after, and the way that the news, the media, is covering this, and the way that they're talking in the media versus the way the bill talks, right? The bill is talking mental health. The media is talking mental illness, right? So even on that level of how they're spinning it and the mentally yeah. ill and dangerous, you know, like, thanks a lot, Assemblyman O'Donnell. What the hell?
Yep.
Like, so, why? I should try to get these people on the show, ask them to explain to them what it is they're trying to do.
Uh-huh.
There's an idea. It's almost a month.
That's a good idea. Now, ADAPT recently had a demonstration in some direct action in Albany about community choice and nursing homes and stuff. And I guess 28 people from the ADAPT organization or disorganization out of Rochester were arrested to bring attention to their issue. And they've received some good media, and we are going to have to do something to get our truth, the truth, out there somehow.
To the mainstream media, they don't want to hear it, and there's the way it's just been so horrible. You know how I'm addicted to this 24-hour news cycle, right? And it's so disgusting. The way that they position everybody, regardless of whatever they're talking about, but particularly when it comes to people with psychiatric histories, it really is criminal. I think the collusion between like TAC and the media, and that 60 Minutes special, and good for ADAPT. That's just awesome, and you know. But all around, there's no, everybody is losing their freedoms. And so that, you know how like when people would say, you know, if you're faced with mental health court or jail or prison time, do the time, because at least then it's done. And in mental health court, you never know when you're going to get out. Like, this law changes that.
Well,
I mean, hell.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
George?
Yeah, you can go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, but then the other problem with the expansion of Kendra's Law that Senator Kathy Young also put out, S-2225-D-2013, includes incarceration. And in the qualifier for Kendra's Law, it's now up to 48 months that they can go back for a quote-unquote danger to self or others, which Tina pointed out before is really like pejorative language at this point. And so they can go back 48 months, but the time that you were institutionalized or incarcerated is like not part of that 48 months. So if you've been in an institution incarcerated one day, they can go back 48 months and one day. If you've been incarcerated or in an institution for 10 years, they can go back 10 years and 48 months. And so, like, this permanent record, and like Yvonne always brings up the electronic medical records, it's really scary. And they're going after a population of people that the general society does not have any sympathies for. And next it comes, you know, and next it goes where? It goes to everybody else. And they don't realize it because it's already in the schools. It's already in the mental systems. It's already, you know, it's getting into your general practitioner's office.
And my observation from watching several hundred treatment over objection, mental hygiene court hearings, that any diagnosis of mental illness means dangerous. That's how it's presented to the judge, and that's what's accepted, the diagnosis. And if it's untreated, unmedication, it's very dangerous. So just having the diagnosis is the standard for dangerousness. No behavior, just the diagnosis. And last year in Syracuse, New York, at those hearings, 6 to 12 people every week were sentenced to a lifetime of psychiatric drugs because of a diagnosis. One medium-sized city.
Absolutely criminal. And all fraud, and nobody's speaking out, and people who are in positions of power to speak out, who have access to federal level, state level people, are saying that if you talk about anti-psychiatry, you are not considered credible. And, like, I just, one of the things that I've been asking people who have been involved in the movement for a long time, and just in case anybody doesn't know, this is the George Ebert that I always talk about as the person who really changed my life and opened my eyes to all of this. So when people call in who have been involved in the movement for decades, I ask them, do you have any stories that come to your mind about what it used to be like in the early days of the movement and what the movement was about?
And I'm not sure what you're asking, but we did have the movement did have a declaration of principles from the Toronto 10th Annual Conference on Human Rights and Psychiatric Oppression, and that's what people in the movement stood by. And 1982, I believe.
Yes, and that's the Declaration of Principles that's reread every year at Bastille Day and reaffirmed, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and
We don't talk about mental health issues, mental health problems, mental illness. We talk about organized psychiatry as being the problem, and what it causes people and what it does to people.
And what it does is plenty of abuse and torture. And Sue Wittenberg keeps calling in and saying, Lauren, it's psychiatric genocide. And she's right, it is psychiatric. And others have said that. This is...
We talked about that in the early days. There's a lot of writing about that in the early days. What's going on at the National Institute of Mental Health with all the genetic research confirms our fears of where things are going. It's pretty much genocide. And one of your shows, you mentioned how many of the drugs depress, suppress people's sexuality. It's out of 1984?
Yeah, right. Which tube are you going to be in? It's really it's so scary, and I think that when people are just learning about this, just first, you know, stumbling over this idea of what the rights issues are versus what's being put forth in the peer industry and stuff, for people to know, like, you guys used to, like, get together on college campuses, right, and that the government wasn't funding this, and it was... you know, people coming together naturally, and I think that these kinds of things to remind people of what the roots of this was, so that maybe, you know, if not all, maybe some, or, you know, if you're one person out there listening who's like, wait, this is what I'm talking about, this other thing isn't really what I was planning on, that they know that there are things that they can do locally and to get involved in different efforts that isn't funded by the government.
We got together at college campuses and campgrounds when the Alliance hosted the 11th annual conference in Syracuse. We held it at Syracuse University. The rooms were $15 a night, and breakfast was like $2, lunch was $3, and dinner $4. There are ways for people to get together without prices have gone up definitely, but people can get together without going to high-priced hotels and all the extras.
Yeah, and I think that this thing on July 11th and 12th in Utica will be reaffirming for a lot of us who go and get back to some of this idea of just, we just need to be together and to come up with ideas and then work on them together. And that, you know, all these rules and the formalization of how everything has occurred, part of the problem, that's part of the problem. I don't know if you heard last night, there was a new article that came out from the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services saying that if you're involved with peer services, your cost for drugs and other psychiatric services are higher than if you're not involved with peer support services.
I saw that on Facebook. I wasn't quite sure what it meant.
From when I was able to read it, from my reading of it anyway, what I understand is if you're involved with peer services, it's less likely that the cost that you're costing the state in Medicaid, it will be less cost in the institution, which is good, very good, but you'll have higher cost in terms of what psychiatric drugs you're on and what psychiatric services you're using. Medicaid will be paying more if you're involved with peer support. So that concerns me.
Yeah, well, why? Why would that be happening?
My guess is because the people who are working in peer roles are people who are chosen to work in them because they comply with psychiatric services, and their job is to get other people to comply with it.
Oh, all right.
I mean, it's just my guess, but, you know. Of course, the Center for Medicaid Managed Care, Medicare Services, CMS, is saying that it may wind up being better because people are getting more services. So even though it costs more to have peer support services there, it might wind up being better. And so, of course, you know, it's growing the machine, so how could it not be better, right? But it's concerning.
Definitely.
Yeah. And then somebody called the other night saying that there were peer specialists or whatever their title was, who were the people who were collecting urine samples from people. And so how this can be a peer relationship, I'm not exactly sure. You know, and the power differential is just outrageous. And so it's a scam to tell people that you're like a peer or an equal or any of it. And like, so, you know, in California, I saw the other day, they're expanding 33,000 quote unquote peer positions, whatever they are. You know what I mean? Like, who knows what these things even are? Line 202, your line is open.
Hello, Lauren. This is Yvonne Smith.
Hello, Yvonne.
And I want to give you my theory on it. The reason why there is more service billings when peers are involved is because what happens is usually, not always, but usually the peers that are involved, that have been hired, they know how the system works. So many times what happens is that people want to have service. They want to see a therapist for 50 minutes. You know, they want psychiatry. Some people try to access those things. And what happens is other peers who are working there, they know how to access those services. So instead of trying to get people to be involved in natural support, for many years I was poo-pooed for talking about support groups and things like that that were natural support. And other people who were peer specialists would tell me privately, Yvonne, that doesn't give any dollars for my agency. If we refer them to a support group or natural support, I talk about support groups and joining health clubs and other things in your community. And they say that this does not provide any money. So they count on peer specialists, and I say there's a difference between peer support and peer specialists. So peer specialists are expected to generate income for their agency. And in doing that, they will have more billable hours for the services that CMS says that they want to have, whether it's community support, counseling, whatever. And so that is why you see an increase, because the peer specialists have been corrupted. They've been co-opted. Instead of trying to help people to get involved in natural supports in their community, and I can give some examples. I don't want to take up a lot of time, but there are examples of wherein a peer support person can help. For example, a person who has very spiritually oriented toward their faith and their church that may have been, and I've seen this happen to many people where they've been very much involved in their church, and because during the time of a crisis they had behavior that the church didn't understand, they didn't want them there. Where it would be naturally speaking, and I'm saying this, that they would be natural for the peer specialist to go with the peer to the church to explain that at the time that this behavior was happening, they were in crisis, and to explain to this and to provide a way for them to get back into the church. And I'm not talking about just going to church service. I've had people who have been isolated from being involved in volunteer duties, being on usher board, and things like that, natural supports that they would have. And so what the peer person says is, well, yeah, we can do that, but that's not going to provide income for my agency. Who provide income for my agency is to say they need X number of hours in a possible hospitalization or a socialization program that's going to talk about these different things. And basically most of those are about taking on chemicals. So that's why you see an increase, in my opinion.
Well, I think it definitely, yeah. I mean, I think that this whole issue of it being something that's even billable to begin with is part of the problem. This CMS article looked specifically at peer support programs, and they identified this as, quote, services consisting of social, emotional, and instrumental support delivered in the community by persons having a mental health condition to others sharing a similar mental health condition to bring about a desired social or personal change. And so that's their...
But Lauren, you hear me. What I'm saying is some of those things that would bring about that change doesn't necessarily be billable. The thing about it is that you want to help people to... I think the goal should be that people should not be involved in the mental health system, that they should find natural supports in their community.
Right.
And whatever they are, it's whatever they choose to be, or whatever, working with someone you find what's available to them. And I think that's not happening.
Right.
And if you see that people are more involved in billing more for billable services, that says that actually it's a failure.
Right.
And what's happened is that, as you said a couple of nights ago, is that people that are coming in now don't know the history of why people were involved. People were involved in coming to the system because we were going to be system agents, change agents. And that's occurring. Now they're just the same thing as mental health technicians. And so that's not happening.
Yeah. Yeah, the entire thing is a failure. But what I'm saying is, I guess I'm not saying, well, why is this? But I'm saying, why are we still supporting this? That if the finding is that you're more likely to be involved with psychiatric services if you're involved with peer support, why the hell is anybody supporting, funded peer support? I'm never talking about these natural alternatives, and I think it's important that you point this out, because those I truly and fundamentally believe in. But those aren't things that are provided by the state or the government or something that you can bill for. Here, it says right here, peer support was also a significant predictor of a higher professional cost and prescription drug cost. Like, so, like, there should be a warning label on anybody coming in contact with a peer specialist or a peer whatever, that you're more likely to wind up in more services and be on more drugs if you don't. You might wind up getting hospitalized if you don't talk to me, but if you do talk to me, you're going to wind up costing more money on drugs and services.
Well, as the person that said they called in the other day, in a particular state where they were required to help assist in drug testing to see if the person was on drugs. That was
right. Never
when we thought about this many years ago. We would never think that we would be involved in anything like that. And there was active discussions. People were saying, oh, I don't want people to be paid for Medicaid. I remember distinctly, over a decade ago, having discussions with people in large groups, and people said, well, yes, we want to be paid, but we don't want to have Medicaid billable services. And the reason being is that it becomes the driver. It's the same thing with the same thing about peer specialists and what has happened to the doctors. If you look at most of your states, and I'm saying this for people, I always think about social action. In any state, if you've got mental health is basically paid for by Medicaid. You can find out from your Medicaid board. They keep this data, and it's available to you. I know this because I've been in meetings in my own local state a few years ago. They don't want to have me there now. But they would tell you that the outliers, they call them outliers, the physicians who, for example, give people three or four antipsychotic medications that eventually 3 years down the line will lead them to being on kidney dialysis. They know who these people are. It's the same thing for the peer support people, because what happens, there's a difference between peer support and peer specialists. Peer specialists are strictly a Medicaid animal. And I would hope that people like Larry Fricks, Celia Brown, Janet Paleo, I would hope that one day that they would agree to be on the show to discuss this.
And Celia has been on, but it would be great. And I think that, you know, in New York, part of the reason why I'm so tuning in on this, on top of the national stuff, is because in New York, we're just going through it because people have been successfully fighting it off for decades, and now it's been railroaded in, and so I'm just really being exposed to like what these realities are, and then from going around the country and talking to people, the horror stories I heard about what in places where it is billable, it's like, it's just really scary. And I understand people who say, and I said this last night when we were talking about this, some of my best friends work as peer specialists and peer support people and run peer programs. And so this is not like a personal thing or about anybody's actual individual work. It's about the structure of it and how the structure of it is. And what
a person
is
working in a peer agency, when a person is working for a peer agency, and I have been on both sides. I've worked for a peer agency where I've gone into a place. It's different when you work for a peer agency and they have a definite contract to do something, and the peer agency protects you from the abuses of using peer support in an adverse way. And I would hope that some people might call in that's involved in real true peer support, because real true peer support is very good. And the only reason why we were saying that people would get paid because is that many people put a lot of money out of their own pockets, myself, other people do, and they don't get any really support of it. And you can't really ask people for donations or whatever else. But the real true peer support has to do with people mutually giving support to each other. I remember when I came out of the hospital and there was a girl, her name was Linda Jones. I was at the time, and they load you up with so much medication that you can't do very much of anything. I couldn't travel the subway. I couldn't shop or do anything for myself. And it was not necessarily because of the illness per se, because a few months before that, I had worked for a Fortune 500 company, and I was making complicated decisions at the time. I was not a high-level person. I was just a worker bee. This is what happens when a good idea becomes corrupted, and we don't do enough to support peer support agencies who are doing stuff in this peer form, and we should say, who is doing the work locally that's helping peers and support them financially and in kind, and not even financially, but in kind to support them versus going into what I call provider agencies who are going to be coercive. And what their interest is in providing more use of psychiatry, more medications, not less, not helping people to be involved in the natural supports in their community. I would say for myself that the reason why I ended up in the hospital was because of a lack of natural supports. And what has kept me out is RAP and helping myself being involved in natural supports, you know. And we're just not having a lot of that. And I would hope that some people who are listening to the show that would call in and talk about the nature of using natural supports and how the peer specialist community has become very corrupt. It was it's like, you know, home court. It was a very good idea in the very beginning, but somehow it got diverted from its original purpose.
Well, I'll tell you how. I'll tell you exactly how. But first I want to say the number is area code 267-521-0167, and the toll-free line is 855-346-3351. So how it happened, Yvonne, is that people weren't allowed to write words like independent external advocacy, and so it became other things. And so you go one or two generations down from the people who were originally at the table writing the regulations or policies or whatever, and they don't know what concessions were made in order to get what they got passed. And I certainly didn't think what's going to happen three generations down when the people who are hiring people for these jobs, nobody even knows. Because we were such a cohesive group that had been working together for years that we all knew each other. And we couldn't imagine not knowing anybody who was doing it, or at least I couldn't. And so then you have all of these things of where independent external advocacy becomes, advocacy, becomes self-advocacy, becomes, you know, and then you're not even allowed to print it anymore, right? So, and then when you have 2 or 3 years or 4 years of where you're having tens of thousands of people getting educated into it, and those words aren't there, they don't know that 15 years ago there were fights about that.
They don't know the history of it, and the thing about it is I blame some of the things in the movement for that, because when I first started going to alternatives back in 1998, we used to have what they would call planks. We would have meetings after supposedly the conference daytime was over with, where we hit topics like recovery, where we came to consensus. They did away with those type of meetings that were held after 5:30 at night. And
Yvonne, you want to hear something really funny? You want to hear something really funny? In 98, or definitely by 99, there were many of us who were boycotting it because they started including professionals being allowed to present workshops at alternatives. So those planks that you're talking about, that was already a whole thing down. And then when you think about the International Conference on Psychiatric Oppression and Human Rights that was being held up until the time the federal government kind of bought the whole thing out, with the exception of individuals who have continued over the last, 30, 40 years to try to bring this through, if I didn't know George, I hope you're still there. If I didn't know George, I I wouldn't know almost anything I know.
Well, that's why they don't want people like you and I to be in the room. Like I said, I just need someone to email me who got a new position because they want to know more about peer support and peer. They want to know more about peer specialists. And I emailed them back immediately and said, I'd be happy to talk to you, but I want you to understand that peer support and peer specialists are two different things. The same thing that happened, and I'm doing the same. I'm making the same mistake because some of these things I just refuse to participate in. But I realized one thing. By refusing to participate, you make it so people don't have the knowledge. And I have re-judged myself to say that I cannot not participate because what happens is I see the younger people, what they're doing is they're repeating the same, they're going over the same ground that we covered 15, 20 years ago. Now, in 1998, when I went to my first alternative, was in Long Beach. And I didn't go back until it was in Atlanta because of cost. I haven't been to alternatives in 2 years because of cost. And George would speak out when we would be in campgrounds and things like that. And what happens is now when you go to the conferences, there are many corporations that are there. They have organized that way to have consumer networks. And that's one of the reasons why I feel is the National Consumer Coalition has failed because they failed to take into account people who are very active, who didn't have 501c3s, who weren't consumer networks. They organized in a formal structure, which I could understand having it, but for purposes of lobbying, for example, Congress, it doesn't work that way because people that get money from the state or from the federal government, they don't want to make waves. It's people like you, I think, and other people. They're the people. We're the people who are out here. This is a civil rights movement.
It is
not necessarily about health care. And that's what has become part about is let's get more people. That's why you see the increase in cost of people being cost because it's suddenly been about access. The access and having people to be provided with more services. And that's what it is. And people get better when they get involved in advocacy. And there's a reason for that. And you have to think about it. When people get involved in advocacy, suddenly they start getting well.
Yeah, and it's funny because I got an email from, I think it came from OMH Central Office, maybe the Office of Regional Advisory, I don't know, but it's about the Regional Advisory Committee, and buried in this letter where they're talking about reaching out to NAMI to have them come participate in the Regional Advisory Committee meetings. It says, I've spoken with people, and in parentheses, recipients and family members, who expressed that their concerns, their opinions, and their input are not being heard. When I asked whether or not they were participating in the advisory committee meetings or any of the meetings, webinars, et cetera, offered by the Office of Mental Health, Office of Consumer Affairs, representing both the recipient and family input to OMH, the usual response was that they weren't. Sometimes people feel that they are not being heard. It's difficult to be heard when you are not being, when you are silent and not being part of the process. Is like not voting and then complaining about who got elected. So it's really kind of horrifying to me that, the Office of Consumer Affairs refers to us as recipients and then our family members.
I can say one thing that Office of Consumer Affairs around the country, they have under the mental health program directors that you always refer to when you say where people find the information about Darby Penney's trauma
and women. The National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, NASHPID.
Right. They also have a co-group of Office of Consumer affair directors.
Yes, naturally.
And I'm not going to get down on them harshly because they vary. I only know the ilk of where I live, which is poor. If they want family and consumers to be involved, usually their budgets are in the district. We're only 600,000 people.
You mean people who are being when you say consumers, you mean people who are being subjected to psychiatry?
Yes, people who are being subjected to psychiatry. What they can do, and as I said to my local, because they don't listen to me, is I say for some people there's a cost in attending those meetings. If you want peers to be involved, you want families to be involved, when they come to the meetings, you offer to them transportation costs. And for some people, that's the reason why they're not there. I don't think that's the case with NAMI, because usually they're upper middle class.
Well, I have a whole lot to say about that, but Amy, are you on the line here?
Yes, yes.
Hi.
Beautiful Eckley. Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Oh, I'm good.
You
weren't just had a horrible thunderstorm. Yes, I do. First of all, I wanted to address that statement. Now, I have to say I have not read the article that you were referring about the peer specialists, but you cited data regarding
Amy, can I just interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
Can you turn the volume on your computer down? Because they're getting a lot of feedback.
I'm on my phone.
Oh, could it be maybe, are you on speaker?
No.
Okay. Okay, sorry.
And I haven't been calling because I'm having constant technical problems, but I am just on my cell phone, so.
Okay, I think whoever it was maybe had it down. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Okay, that's okay. But anyway, to suggest that people who have had contact with peer helpers have higher utilization rates is just twisted because what happens is that they assign peer workers to people with high utilization rates to monitor them. That's the population that gets those services, so that's skewed, a skewed statement. And then what I wanted to do was just talk a little bit about what happened to a drop-in center that I used to direct. We have had in Colorado managed care, capitated managed care for 13 or 14 years now. And so we had a 1915 B waiver, which meant that we could use Medicaid dollars for non-medical use that promoted recovery. So we never had to certify peer specialists or, you know, do any fancy dancing around drop-in centers or clubhouses. It was all this, you know, free ride, very generous. And so I was directing this big urban drop-in center in a very oppressed area that served a mental health center that had the highest level of need folks in that area. Lots of homeless people. Also had a department that was, they called it DDMI for developmental disabilities and mental illness. And so, and we would serve 100 hot meals a day, twice a day. So it was big. And, when I was running it, I don't want to, like, brag or anything, but it was a peer-run facility, and the community ran it on a consensus basis, which was the most gigantic pain in the ass that you can possibly imagine. It took them weeks to make a rule about coffee cups or something. But everyone brought their own issues to the table, and, you know, the consensus model, everyone needed to speak and be heard from. All opinions were valid, and if someone in the room didn't like it, the responsibility of the rest of the room was to help them like it or get to a point where everyone liked it. So, but it was awesome, yeah. And they tackled enormously important things, like whether or not clinical staff was allowed in the building, or should folks be able to watch pornography on the computers. You know, really very important things. So, anyway, long story short, I left, and they started hiring non-peer staff, not clinical people, but just people off of Craigslist or something. And now, 5 years later, there are only two peer staff left on the staff of maybe 20 people. They're all, most of them are clinical clinicians that are also working at the mental health center nearby, and they're rotating interns through the drop-in center like it's a training area. And it is just the saddest thing, and it reflects, though, our attitude and ideas about this particular company also housed a great peer specialist model that was very relationship-based, and you know, where one person is sitting in a room with another person with the door shut talking and writing notes and having supervision from a peer every week. You know, it was a fabulous model. That's all gone. And the models that have taken their place are all, a third of our core competencies in Colorado have to do with compliance. Know the illness, know the treatments, know when to report. It is just despicable. So these little case studies, Colorado is a great state to watch because we do many things early for federal incentive dollars so that other states know what not to do, you know, and we also are following in many ways in New York State's policies and laws and rules and regulations and legislation, but we have no informed consumer voice here, you know, the opposite of the East Coast. So it's going to be an interesting social experiment, like run, run, run. You know, don't sign your name. So it's really alarming.
Amy, this is Yvonne. I just want to ask this question because I saw this happening suddenly, and it may not be countrywide, but you can comment on it. When we had the recession, there were jobs that were kind of earmarked for peers. They were peer specialists. But then when you had the recession come about and you had people who, I call them, they had situational emotional distress because they had lost their quote-unquote big company jobs. I saw them coming in and taking those jobs. People were, I would say, I don't want to slap my hand and somebody's going to pick on me about it, who just had a passive involvement in the mental health system, meaning that maybe they went to a psychiatrist a couple of times because they lost their job or something like that, or they had a child who had some mental health service, and they came in and they took those positions, and they weren't quite as mental health, they weren't quite as, I shouldn't say you were, they weren't quite as much bent on the civil rights aspect.
Yeah.
Who came in.
Because they didn't have civil rights challenges for the most part.
Well, they didn't have the experience of being hospitalized. Like, I don't have years and years, but I have been hospitalized. They didn't have the experience of being hospitalized. They didn't have the experience of, like Lauren and Sue Weinberg talked about, of being abused. They didn't have those experiences. So, therefore, their whole idea was that access to care and helping people to get access to drugs and psychiatry was what they were about. And they would say that, well, this is what we're about. We're not about being activists. And
but you and I know, and
Lauren can speak to this as well, is that one of the major points, even when the people in Georgia did this, was that we were supposed to be involved in changing the system from within. It was like we were going to be molded and go in there and somehow change it. In the early years, a few years, it did. We changed words. Consumer is not used like it was used now.
Right.
And words do mean something. And where I live, something like 70% of the people who were in the public mental health system were labeled with a diagnosis that had to do with psychosis or schizophrenia. And we kind of moved out of
Amy, Yvonne, I don't want to interrupt you, but I don't want to lose the thread of what we were talking about because I don't think it was that benign that people, you know, were kind
of not benign at all. It's purposeful. That on purpose.
Well, and because I know, you know, like I forgot what I was going to say. That's when I interrupt you is because it's like I have a thought that is slipping
away. But it wasn't that benign, and it was something that was constructed, and it was intentional, and it was planned before anything was ever even presented.
By the cartel, by the, like in Colorado, CBHC, the Behavioral Health Council, the MHA, Mental Health America, NAMI, Federation of Families, and then, you know, if they can drag along both of the APAs and the social workers and the peer org as well, all the better, and they call the shots, they give each other all the money. When I was fired from my job, I had an attorney, and he wept because I didn't have any money, because he said, this is a RICO lawsuit. And this guy was a federal oversight attorney for health corporations. He knew what he was talking about. He said, they're all giving each other all the money. They're making all the rules. They're giving each other all the contracts. We had a contract out, open bid in Colorado for 5 brick-and-mortar crisis centers, you know. What Colorado wants is the Barco Lounger model, where you get strapped into a Barco Lounge, and they can have hundreds of them in one room, and you're there for 3 to 5 days for an assessment, and, you know, good luck if you have to go to the bathroom or something. There could be people, you know, detoxing on either side of you, because it's an integrated facility, you know. That's what Colorado wants. But Recovery Innovations in Arizona was bidding on the contract, which, you know, it's still an industry thing. It's still, you know, part of the system, but it's 1,000 times better than anything that Colorado has ever even blinked at. And they got the bid, and the mental health centers whined and cried to their legislators. The executive directors of the mental health centers complained to their legislators, and they pulled the contract back from the Arizona folks. And it's criminal.
Amy, for people, could you just, Yvonne asked if you would just explain what RICO is?
It's organized crime. It's a cartel of organizations or individuals who have circled their wagons around a particular industry or product, and they own it, and there is nobody else is allowed to get their foot in the door. And it has to do primarily with money flow, as far as my attorney told me, and which there's plenty of evidence of that. But
usually most of the people who understand about RICO, if you watch The Godfather.
I have not.
Well, you haven't watched The Godfather, but some other people have. But when they talk about the mafia.
Mm-hmm. I watched that one in Norway.
I don't know how accurate that was.
For organized psychiatry, I would say that's about just as good organized crime arguments as I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, they protect each other. I mean, my attorney told me that, and I didn't, you know, honestly, I was so traumatized then, I could barely, you know, I barely knew my own name. And then I had to survive because I was penniless for years after that because I was blackballed then, you know.
I remember you sleeping on the sofa and all that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And all these nice people on Facebook sent me money. I'm going to pay them all back one day. I didn't dive into it. I didn't research it. I didn't look into it. But I'm thinking about it now because, you know, I think lawsuits, whistleblower actions, and I do have some good, solid ideas for delivering great services to peers without being engaged with behavioral health, like working for like my son just got on long-term care, and he has a PCP, personal care provider, coming to his home. And this woman would come in and do his dishes. And I would say, well, you know, he's on a road to citizenship. He doesn't need somebody to do his dishes. He needs somebody to help him understand why to do his dishes and how to do his dishes and when to do his dishes, you know. Like a peer that could be his companion and could, you know, go to the movies with him and stuff like that. So I explained it to the CEO of the assisted care business, and they're going to open up an arm just for mental health because there's lots and lots of mental health folks on long-term care in Colorado, and there's no services for them. When you go to the directory, it all says, yes, our folks can easily lift 75 pounds and clean feeding tubes, you know. There isn't anything that says we're warm and loving and spiritual and kind. And so he's going to – I was explaining to him what peer specialists do typically, and he says, oh, I can't afford people like that. And I said, oh, yes, you can. You know, they work for a slave now. They'd be happy to work. And then there's no oversight. You go into somebody's house, you do what you will, you know, and it's perfect. And running adult foster care beds is another great way to – you can run 3 foster care beds. You get reimbursed by the state, you know, to a couple $1,000 a head. You get 3 of your friends in our long-term care into your home, and you share a home together, and you have an $8,000 a month income. You know?
Well, the thing about it is, Amy, what you're saying, the things you described, they are all things that are accessible to be billable under Medicaid. They're all accessible. Those
but they're not in the behavioral health umbrella.
They're not?
Not adult foster beds. And well, I'm talking about Colorado, where we have a very, very, very lean state government. And once you're on long-term care, you have disappeared. If you don't make any noise and you receive at least a 15 minutes increment of service every 30 days, they are not in your hair, you know. So and the same thing with adult foster beds. We just don't have the staff for oversight here. So it might be different in other states, you know. But I have a number of plans for other funding streams because I don't want to touch a dime of any kind of health money anymore. It just is not to be trusted.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
community development,
I understand where you're coming from, but
at-risk girls.
What I was referring back to is that originally what peer support was and when it was supposed to be billable under Medicaid, which, as I said, I don't care for it, but it was to help people with those daily living skills. We're like bathing, socialization, like you were talking about going to the movies and why you should wash dishes and how to wash dishes, how to, you know.
I think I'm getting this, but I just wanted to say that, like, for as many people who have, like, real needs that are often rooted in economics, like, there are some of us who just got locked up in this shit because of the way that we thought or because of experiences that we had. And we don't need anything. We need to be left alone. And so this idea that, you know, that everybody has needs and that if you solve
right.
the economic – if you solve the economic issues for people, the majority of everything else, I mean, it might still suck or it might still be really, you know, so great that somebody thinks that you're, you know, quote-unquote manic, but at least the financial issue is straightened out. But as long as that financial issue persists, it's going to wind up, but that not everybody who winds up in these things need people to do anything for them except
they would just need to be left alone. I agree with what he said. There are some people who they don't need anything. They just need you to out of their life. There are other people who it might be helpful to them if they want it, if they decide. It's all about choices.
Yes.
If they choose to, if their life is chaotic and they think that they could use with some help, it's just giving them. So most people are not getting the help that they ask for. I like I said, I know many people, but this is the case where they are being pressed on getting assisted outpatient treatment or guardianship because they ask for service.
Right.
And they're
right.
not getting it.
Right.
So,
and
that's
part of that should all come under RICO too, as far as I'm concerned. Thanks for the new angle on this, Amy. I really appreciate it because I think that what is going on here is criminal, and I think any way that people can figure out ways of helping people who are you know, in need of getting, like, you know, their life to where they want it to be able to do it without it having to be something that's even quote unquote psychiatric, and to, like, really expose that fraud. And to talk about how it is
that these things actually happen. I mean, what you described of the difference between the peer-run drop-in center when you were there versus how it is now.
Well, and how it evolved and so quickly. I think it's a good indicator. And I am with you. I absolutely do not think that anyone should engage in behavioral health at all right now. And if you're in it, you should get out because it's dangerous. They're heading
absolutely.
In a dangerous direction. But I do recognize, and Yvonne posted something earlier today about how, you know, it's how tough it is to make the call about whether or not to continue working within the industry, because there are times that I feel like I have turned my back on my brothers and sisters and walked away, and they absolutely feel that way. They do, because I don't want to engage with the system any longer, but there are still people that need help and need knowledge and need to be exposed to other ways of thinking, and how is that going to happen if none of us are engaged with the system at all, ever, you know? So it is, that's another question for another day, maybe, but.
You do have to, I advocate, I call myself, I used to have this because when I used to go to the state hospital, and I still go, and they would say, don't be running any Harriet Tubmans here. And, they think that I would be trying to get people out. And I'm telling you that even when I had a contract, people would feel this way. But the thing about I encourage people not to use the public mental health system at all. I know that there are people who, at the point in their life, they need such an array of services that natural peer supports might not help them at the time because they just need so much. They're so dependent, and we have to wean them off of being very, very, very dependent. And there are people like that. They have generationally been so involved with whether it's mental health or welfare system or whatever, and you have to kind of teach them how to wean themselves off. There are other people, as Lauren says, we just need to be left alone and that we can kind of fend for ourselves. But there is a kind of an in-between or whatever that people are of that built that they need to be it. And like I said, they still, even though we're not there, or we might not be there, they have other people, and they're indoctrinating the people toward being part of being a mentally ill person. And I don't believe that
people are
mentally ill.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these are definitely complicated issues, and I'm not sure it's just clear cut, because I know that financially every problem that I have is stemmed out of a financial base. And so, you know, if you get blackballed, like Amy was saying, it gets really hard to create any kind of work for yourself. I just want to say, area code 207, we've been having some trouble with the line, so if you're trying to jump in on this conversation, your line is open.
Yes, Richard Chalk. I'm Richard from Brum. Where am I at now? I'm in Maine.
Hi, Richard.
This is a really good topic, and a lot of good feedbacks are coming through. And I've been following and listening to a lot of different avenues, a lot of different shows from across the country. It seemed to be that we're coming across, we're going into a new transition in our world called electronics. People have noticed that lately we've been seeing ads where you can hook these little monitors to your body to monitor your heart from whatever facility you're near, your blood pressure, yada, yada, yada. We're going to be entering a realm of the same technology is going to be doable for mental health. Now, what I'm straving at, what I'm trying to hit a topic on is, a lot of calls have been saying, stay out of behavioral health, mental health. You guys are right. We're right on target. Stay the heck out of mental health. Go to the services. Get what we need as far as if the person needs help with housing, getting signed up for Medicaid, Medicare, or transportation, yes. But when it comes to psychiatric this personal thought, when I'm not hearing from peers in my own, from seeing peers where I live here in Brunswick, Maine, stay the hell out of it. Because it's a money pit. It's a money pit, money pit, money pit. I was recently at a meeting with CEO and providers. And when you look on your EMR, electronic medical record, or your health chart, you'll see two things on there. One side is for physical diagnosis, and the other one side is for psychiatric. Well, when you use for psychiatric, there's five codes they use. They use those five codes. Now, those five codes are what could get a person in trouble. They do not use what the actual code is. I better slow down here. Like, say if a person is in there for maybe anxiety. Anxiety is going to fall under bipolar. A person in there for maybe has a nervous disorder. That's also going to fall under, if I'm correct, under bipolar. Why? Because they can bill more money for it compared to just putting in what the actual billing code is. And we're headed to a place where all this is money, money, money motivated. Well, how is this money? Why are you saying this, Richard? Well, what's proposing these contracts are the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry. They have so much money invested in this.
Trillions.
I'll stop for a second.
No, you don't have to stop. I'm right there with you. And I think that we've been talking about the electronic medical records and also like initiatives that DARPA is doing in implanting devices into the brains of veterans who have been diagnosed with a psychiatric assignment. And that we're just when the skin patches where they have these things that and it's happening. And it's just a heartbeat away if it's not already happening in places in pre-research phase or whatever, where they're developing this and that we are going to be further under control. And when a doctor sees that the psychiatric history, if there's one, they ignore anything physical. I mean, people have called in on the show on different occasions talking about how they're afraid to go to a medical doctor or when they go to a medical doctor that they're then subject to a mental health evaluation because they see that they have a psychiatric history. So even though there's clearly something like physical going on, like somebody is bleeding or somebody is, got something that you can actually see, because there's a psychiatric history, they have to go through an evaluation first. And they're killing us. They're killing us.
I got one for you. I found there's two good hospitals here. I got to give them a plug. One's called the Adventist Hospital in Brunswick. The other one's called Midcoast Hospital in Brunswick, Maine. Excellent. They finally, I went into the hospital thinking I'm going nuts. Well, make a long story short, I said I want to have a full chemical workup. I want a full study. I want a full thing, everything that's in my body, chemicals, and I want x-rays done. It turns out that I have this thing called gout. Severe crippling arthritis. And for years they would say, Richard, what have you been doing? And I'd say, well, whenever I get like this, I go to the hospital. The hospital will come in and say, well, you're out of control. We're going to send you over to the psych hospital. And I go to the psych hospital, and then they stick me on these meds. Then I take these meds. Then I'm okay for a few days. And I go home. Then I get sick. Then I quit the meds. And blah, blah, blah. It keeps going round and round and round. So that was a revelation for me. It finally took where I had two good people that actually listened and did a full and let me know what was going on. But we have to be our own advocates, and we have to educate our peers. We cannot, and this is the truth, we just cannot rely on the system. The system is screwed. When I sit in meetings with executive directors, and they always talk about get a billing number. And when the rest of the room, not one single person opened their mouth and said anything, it made me think a little bit. Richard, you're on to something here. And then when I go back to my own community, and now I'm getting blackballed by an organization called Sweetser because I used to complain about them a lot. And now I'm getting screwed over by them in a roundabout way. But, I mean, we have to be educated about ourselves. We have to be educated, and we have to educate other people. We have to let people know about DSM, what a DSM is. We have to be very, very conscientious about watching where our billing goes. A lot of people that are dual eligible, that we see main care, Medicare, they could care less. A lot of them could care less because they figure, what do I care? Someone else is paying the bill. But no, no, no. A lot of these organizations are billing for services that are not being rendered, are billing for time that's not being rendered. Kind of what I'm talking about? Kind of what I'm talking about?
I'm just listening because it's great to hear you saying it, and it's horrible what's happening. And this is what Amy said before. This is RICO. This is organized crime, and this is another person that is been blackballed for speaking out, and that nobody knows what's going on, and we absolutely must. That's why I think this thing with the Alliance. On the 11th and 12th in Utica, and then the vigil from the 13th to the 16th in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health, of at least in New York, and anybody who wants to join us trying to get back to our roots, because what's going on, this billable, it's bull, you know, like that's...
I'm going to give you another one. I went to this organization called Sweetser, and I told them, I still have the records. I called them up, and I said, I've had a head injury. I want to see a traumatic brain injury specialist or someone. My injury was like in the 80s, but I want to see someone that has knowledge about individual adults with traumatic brain injury. And they told me yes, yes, yes. Well, it turned out, no, they don't even have a qualified person. This is what I just found out. And if someone's on the air in this area, please correct me. The state of Maine does not have anybody that accepts, that has someone that's qualified for TBI in the state of Maine that's dual eligible. They do not. None of these organizations do. There's only one organization where a guy told me the truth, and that was CHCS, and his name was Dale Hamilton. He told me the truth. He said, Richard, I'll tell you, we don't have anybody. He's the only one in this whole state. I know I'm going to receive crap from this come next week because I'm sure someone's going to be listening on this and I'm going to get the downplay, but I've had it. Enough is enough is enough. Got to speak up. And that's what I'm
all
doing, and
do
I hope other people start doing it too. Thank you all. Listen.
Listen, push pharmaceuticals on you. That's all they want to do. And the thing about it is you have to understand this. Is that they never met a customer, somebody who couldn't be their customer. And that's all that this is about. It's just like Amy said, it is a RICO. It is an illegal enterprise that's all about making money. And that's why I urge people. I sent out about 10 or 12 shares on my Facebook page alone for people to call the show. You should listen in every night, come with pencil and paper, so you can get information, and also ask a buddy to come to be on the program as well so that they can listen in. Because this information, the mainline press is not giving you this information. It's not out there, just like Richard was saying.
Right, and so Yvonne, I just want to say to Richard, thanks so much for calling and sharing all this. And I don't know if you're aware of a simple brain injury support group on Facebook. Michael Idell, my buddy, I just want to give a shout out. He also has a radio show on Blog Talk Radio, and has some really good stuff. And it might be something to look about because so many of us are being brain damaged. If you look at the results from the drugs and the electroshock and just the even just being in solitary confinement can cause organic brain injury. And so this idea of there not being somebody who knows anything about traumatic brain injury is really scary, you know, in terms of that, because people are being actively damaged every day by the system. And maybe if there were more people who specialized in traumatic brain injury, that there would be more people speaking up saying, hey, you should really stop, like, destroying people's brains on top of just general issues of actual physical
traumatic
brain injury. And so, but this issue of billable and making peer,
yes.
These peer things billable, like this is a really big problem, and people need to start speaking out about it. You're more likely to wind up, this CMS report, you're more likely to wind up on drugs and in more psychiatric services if you're involved with a peer specialist or a peer support person than if you're not.
It's cheaper for them to put you on drugs.
Yeah.
It's cheaper for them to have a peer person as well, because, for example, on ACT teams, what happens is ACT is usually, I don't know about other places in the District
this
of Columbia.
This is assertive community treatment. For anybody who might not know, it's assertive community. ACT teams are assertive community treatment is the.
Well, usually it's the most expensive billing. Assertive community treatment is the most expensive billing. And out here, I think they get, it used to be like $140 a day, regardless of how many people were there. So if one person had contact with the person, they got $140 for the day. If they just there for 15 minutes, that's what they got. So that's them. And if they have a peer on the ACT team that goes out and they pay them like just a minimum wage or above like $9 or $10 an hour, they've made so much profit. And that's why where I live, the only place where they have specifically said that they have peer specialists is on ACT teams and in the psychiatric state equivalent hospital. So you're right, Richard. They make so much money having a peer there. It's a money winner for them to have us in ACT teams and in crisis services where they get high billing.
And I'm sorry, it used to be that people called each other sisters and brothers. And so I think that this washing over with this idea of peer, and not to mention the fact that the imbalance in this relationship between two people, where one is keeping records on the other and collecting their urine and convincing them to take
peer,
drugs.
They're doing all that.
Telling them, well, you better comply with this. Listen, I'm going to tell you on the down low over here. You better comply with this, or these people are going to come and take you away, and then you're going to be locked up, and then you're going to be in real trouble, right? Just the coercion of it and the ratting out people and the whole thing.
There's no longer a peer relationship when you have a power dynamic that's there. There's no longer a peer relationship when you are either in the role of a teacher or in the role of a power dynamic. The peer relationship has gone to hell. You're just another orderly. Like they used to have orderlies in hospitals and I don't know what they call them in jail. That relationship no longer avails. And what will happen is when they do studies later, they'll suddenly see, they'll say, oh, the peer is not working anymore. And the reason why, because it's not voluntary, it's not
right.
Mutual, it's not any of the things that we have in values and ethics about peer work. It's no longer that. And so, therefore, it was no longer work because they'd just be wardens to enforce enforce what they're there.
Yeah. Just the slave drivers. And so, Amy, I'm just wondering, are you still there? Because you had said this has been going on in Colorado for 10 or 13 years or something like that?
Yeah.
Hold on,
I was on mute and speaker.
I'm just wondering, like, where, like, from your view of seeing this for 10 or 13 years going on, what are things that, like, the average taxpayer should know?
Well, first of all, capitated managed care was sold to us on the premise that the healthier we were, the less they would have to pay for us, and so therefore it was to their benefit for us to move towards recovery. But what they didn't mention was that the whole ride revolves around you have to have healthy enrollees, and
It's the same thing with the ACA, and that's why there was such an important push to have a particular number of enrollees by a certain time, because if you don't have enough people that are young and healthy enrolling, then the other folks who are actually accessing care, their costs are not met because there's only a capitated means you get paid. The state pays, uses federal dollars to pay providers a certain dollar amount per head per month or per year or something like that. So what happened was that you need to maintain chronicity. It wasn't recovery, it was maintenance. You know,
chronicity, maintain chronicity. That should be like a death metal song. Okay, go ahead.
Yes. I'll be biting on snakes while I sing it. So it turned out that, and see, in this, a lot of managed care and, you know, the Massachusetts plan, which is where the ACA came from, but a lot of it originated with Kaiser protocol management
Kaiser,
stuff.
Yes.
And so with physical health care, it was to their benefit to start with prevention and early intervention initiatives because if they help people quit smoking, if they help people lose weight, if they help people exercise by giving them, you know, memberships to gyms and so on and so forth, which were very benevolent and benign actions, it reduced their costs. And so it was win-win-win. However, in behavioral health, when the only thing that they've got is a pill, early intervention and prevention looks a lot different. And then, you know, and I swear, I know, I wish I would have done a screenshot. I know that Insul wrote a blog about 4 months ago or 3 months ago about how psychiatric medications have seen their day and, you know, it's
just
not common.
And the DSM isn't reliable, right? Yeah.
Right, exactly, yes. And,
it's on the
director's
blog on the if you go to the National Institute of Mental Health's webpage and go to the director's blog, that's where it is, yeah. So.
But it's edited. He changed it because it said that the new direction of NIMH, well, first of all, they're changing all the research protocols, and they're everything that they're doing from now on has to be any research grants, which means all of the university grants, and I mean they are the major research funders of the United States, and all of their new grants have to be of an experimental nature to determine the biological cause of psychiatric disorders. They actually put that in writing and posted it on the internet.
I think I want to propose an experiment where we get the only people who could qualify are legislators and policymakers and psychiatric workers, where we give them drugs and take measures of their brain and watch how the drugs eat their brains away. How ludicrous. How absolutely ludicrous. Richard, I want to bring you in to talk about...
It's a national experiment, Lauren. It's a national experiment. You know, and...
the Corporation of the United States.
Yes, and... he said in that article that the new direction of research is going to be electroshock and other electrical interventions and psychosurgery. It said that in the blog, and now it doesn't say that anywhere. You know, if you put in psychosurgery as a search term on his entire blog, it never shows up. So, but I know I saw it, but it's gone. So it's so frightening. My theory is I really, you know, I do believe that much of this has to do with social control, even when it boils down to mom is hard to handle. I think, really also very, very much a fiscal issue because the ACAPP cannot maintain high-end utilizers. It can't. It can't. It's just simply the math does not add up. And if you watch those Rocky Mountain PBS videos that I posted 100 years ago, I'll have to find them and repost them. But the bean counters are sitting there being interviewed, and they're going, oh, well, we've identified that people with psychiatric disorders are the high-end utilizers. They've got all these comorbid disorders, and they eat up all of our ER time, you know, blah, 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 on public television. It's unbelievable. And they need to round us up and put us somewhere where they can manage our health costs.
And you need to run. Do not walk, and have your friends tune into the show every night. Because we've got somebody on the line, Yvonne.
Somebody who's been on hold for a little while, so I want to bring this person in. Area code 205.
Oh yes. Hi. I'm sorry. My dog is barking. Let me make her stop. We're outside. Hi. This is Leslie. I'm on Facebook with you.
I'm calling from Alabama. Okay.
The awesome state of Alabama.
Hello, Alabama.
yeah.
What
really,
do you want to talk about?
I've only caught a little bit of what you were talking about, but I heard a little bit about managed care, and I'm still on SSDI. I went back to work for a year and a half, and then got fired because of my anxiety. So from a church. That was awesome.
From a church. Great. Good old support. I'm so sorry that happened to you.
I was a special ed teacher before. Basically, I had a premature baby. He was 10 weeks early, weighed 2 pounds, 11 ounces, and my anxiety went through the roof. And I'd had, depression and anxiety in the past, and had taken, one old, tricyclic at a time. I never had been on, any kind of cocktail of drugs. But after my son was born, I just had terrible anxiety, which really now, I begged them to check my hormone levels and my thyroid and all that stuff, because that was my first psychiatric hospitalization was around his due date, which was Labor Day. But they would not do any tests. And my doctor basically medicated me to the point that I lost my job, my teaching job, not the one I just lost, but the one I'd been teaching in the public school system. I was a special ed teacher. I lost my job. I was on 9 medications.
Oh, God.
And I lost my house, I lost everything, and
crime.
Yeah, and it wasn't until I read Robert Whitaker's book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, which it just saved my life. I mean, I was by that time I had lost my health coverage. I had qualified for SSDI, but because I got it very quickly, I didn't qualify for Medicare for. There's a gap. You have to be disabled for 5 months.
24 months.
And you have to be disabled for 5 months before you can apply. And then once you're eligible, you have to wait another 24 months. So I was lost. I was basically, I qualified, but I didn't have any health coverage. And so I ended up going to community psychiatry. And they took me off of Xanax, basically cold turkey, and I've been on 4 milligrams a day, and I felt like I was dying.
That withdrawal.
Yeah, and so then I was, then they did something because I moved, and they basically said I didn't qualify for services anymore, which was not true. They had changed my diagnosis from bipolar disorder, which I never had, to mood disorder not otherwise specified, and somehow there was some miscommunication. I lost services, and so then I was taken off of Paxil completely cold turkey also, right after the Xanax. Yeah, so I toughed it out for 9-10 months, and then I ended up back in the hospital where they put me on the worst drug ever, which was Effexor XR. And back on Klonopin. So it took me 16 months to get off the Effexor, and I'm still on the Klonopin. That's going to be like now I've read and Blake Tracy say that you should wean off of them all at the same time, but I didn't know that, and the Effexor was the worst horrific drug I've ever been on. I mean, I just cried all the time. I had terrible headaches. I mean, that last 37.5 milligrams, it took me probably 8 or 9 months to wean off of that.
Well, people aren't informed about any of this prior to starting them. And if they refuse them, then they're forced. And so they never did a hormone check or any of it, right? They never did.
No, they never did. But I've continued reading up, and I really think that what I had was probably postpartum thyroiditis, because my symptoms, which looks identical to bipolar disorder. I mean, I lost all the weight that I had gained in pregnancy, which was a lot because I had preeclampsia, and I was anxious. I could not sleep. You know, I had insomnia. It was like identical, but they would never check it. And I have a page on Facebook because my thing is, they need to look deeper and figure out why we have these symptoms, you know, and they never will do it. I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah,
They won't
look at the physical. I say this all the time, that there's physical. Sometimes there is, as Lauren says, there is no mental illness. It's a fantasy. It's a fraud. And people are in real distress. I'm not saying that people are not. People are in real distress, and they won't look at the physical things, whether someone has Crohn's disease, whether they have thyroid, or whether they're having, as the other lady said, other conditions. They won't look into that. And
They won't. I mean, yes, you're absolutely right.
Well, I hope that you, when you get off of tonight, because we're only going to be on the show
I'm just wondering, Leslie, would you be willing to just say what your Facebook page is and say a little bit about it?
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to. It's called Examining the Elephant, and
okay.
It's basically my purpose is to talk about I share a lot of things from different, you know, websites and stuff and other Facebook pages, but the basic premise behind my page is to uncover the possible physical causes of symptoms that people call mental illness, because I really truly believe that I believe that people suffer, but I don't think that they're suffering because of something in their mind necessarily. I think it's something, it could very well be something physical. There's so many things that could cause it. I mean, I have food allergies. I have sleep apnea. I mean, I have a million things that I've uncovered myself over the years. Not being well, it's really hard to always carry. When I had sleep apnea, my doctor decided instead of giving me a CPAP, if I had choked one more time in my sleep during the hour, I would have been put on a CPAP, which might have totally cured all the symptoms of depression and anxiety that I had, and daytime sleepiness. I was diagnosed with
And this is one of the reasons why they're killing us, and because the actual physical conditions are disregarded and never even tested for, and if you go in with a physical complaint, you wind up getting a psychiatric evaluation. And so that's called Examining the Elephant, Leslie?
Examining the Elephant, and if I would have stopped, if I checked one more time, I would have got a CPAP, but you know what they gave me instead? They gave me Adderall. So, you feel great when you're on Adderall because you're high, you know? I mean, it's like being on Coke or something, you know? I mean, I was flying.
Well, it's the same scheduled drug. Of course it's like being on cocaine.
The CPAP machine is something that my doctor and my pulmonary doctor and my psychiatrist are working hand-in-hand about that. A lot of people, if they had good sleep hygiene and the CPAP machine,
can you please never use that term again?
Really help.
Yvonne, please never use that term again. As somebody
please
who like,
me.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's Lauren saying, please don't ever use that term again. The sleep H word. It is as bad as mental hygiene as far as I'm concerned. I think that people as somebody who's been having to deal with it for years.
Saying is getting a good night's sleep, and I'm sure that the lady on that, getting a good night's sleep is sometimes the root of a lot of people's problems and the root of mine. I'm not going to use the word sleep again, but I'm just saying that there are things that are not invasive as far as things that will kill your kidneys, cause you to gain weight.
Right.
And I agree with the caller on that about that because I found that to be true too.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying that like.
Won't use the word XXX again, okay?
Yeah. But I do want to, Richard, if you're still there, I am wondering. I heard you say yes, Kaiser when Amy had mentioned Kaiser, and I think it was you. And was that you?
Yes.
Would you be willing to give your understanding to people about what Kaiser is?
Well,
are you talking about Kaiser Permanente?
Well, Kaiser
the HMO?
Yeah, Kaiser overlooks money matters. What's billable, what gets accepted, what's going to be paid out, who's going to make money. That's a cheap rendition that I use. For billable services, my last question, like for time segments, how much time can you spend with a patient? How much is it going to cost?
My mother worked for Kaiser Permanente in Virginia for about. If that's the same thing you're talking about, the HMO, my mother worked for them for about 25, 30 years on it forever. I mean, she worked for them for ages. She may have gone back part-time, actually, but it's a horrible place to work. But, you know, she just kind of got used to working there. But, yeah, most of my early, like the first time I was ever put on a psych drug was after, like, a 5-minute exam by a doctor, and he put me on mimipramine, and then I was put on that really horrible, I'm trying to remember what it was called, but it made me sleep all the time. It was like the worst drug on the earth. I can't remember what it was called, though. But, yeah, Kaiser, the psychiatrist, there was like one psychiatrist that you could see, and he was so awkward, like being with him was so awkward that I was studying pre-special ed, so I was like taking psychology and abnormal psych and stuff like that. So I would like bring in books and talk to him about like, you know, Maslow or something. Anything to not talk about me because he looked like he was gonna laugh every time you were talking to him. And like don't put someone who's quote unquote mentally ill with a man who looks like he's gonna laugh at you. That is like gonna induce paranoia right there.
I found the correspondence.
They're widely quoted. Pay attention to Kaiser.
Richard,
listen to me. Pay attention
Richard,
to Kaiser
yes.
because they're
yes.
widely quoted. I don't agree with what they say most of the time, but if you look at Kaiser Foundation, they are widely quoted in the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, and other papers. So you want to, there's two things. There's Kaiser itself and there's Kaiser Foundation. So you might want to go to their website and pay attention to the propaganda that they're putting out.
And so, Richard, what were you just a correspondent? Yeah.
Yes. Okay, his name is Phil Galewitz, Galewitz. He's a correspondent for Kaiser Health News, 133-0, G is in George Street, uppercase N, uppercase W, Washington, D.C., 2005, phone number 602-654-1310. And he has on here, Who We Are, a journalist-run news service covering healthcare policy and politics. We are part of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, which is not affiliated with Kaiser Permanente. Our stories appear in newspapers and media outlets nationwide, including USA Today, The Washington Post, NPR, and MSNBC.com, as well as our website. And he has web address is www.allowercasekaisandkite.org.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and that's KaiserHealthNews.org.
Yes.
And so people should go check that out. And I think, you know, creating some kind of alternative mainstream where people know what's going on and how to get to places, and that there are those of us out there that are still fighting the fight and wanting to make sure that this remains a civil rights movement. We're out here, and you can get in touch with us. I just want to thank everybody for calling in tonight, and call in any time again. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to make sure that I mentioned the Esmond Green Vigil, which will be held in front of Kings County Hospital Center on Thursday, June 19th from 4 to 6 p.m., and the Alliance's planning thing going on July 11th and 12th in Utica, New York. And then on the 13th, we are going to be meeting the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day Vigil to celebrate the human spirit and speak out against psychiatric oppression. We will be on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health in Albany, July 13th through the 16th. And then July 24th through the 27th will be Mind Freedom International's Creative Revolution Conference in Connecticut at Wisdom House. And the keynote speakers include Robert Whitaker, Mary Ellen Copeland, and they're going to have special things going on hearing voices, Soteria House, peer respites, and open dialogue, and coming off of psychiatric medication and drugs. And so that will be July 24th through the 27th, and you can get information there about Mind Freedom. You can reach the Alliance, the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance, at area code 800-654-7227, 800-654-7227. And then July 28th to the 31st, I think, is going to be Youth Power University in Albany, where young people, I believe up to 30 years old, are going to be attending a University of Systems Advocacy or Peer Advocacy at St. Rose College, and they will be dorming it during the time, and I'm awaiting to hear whether or not I'm going to be one of the professors at this, but I'm excited about the potential opportunity. And so Youth Power in New York State is how you reach them, Youth Power University, and they're on Facebook and Twitter. And if you would like to be on the show as a guest and spend an hour or two focused on a certain issue, or if you just have an issue an idea for a show that you would like to be created, or you have a human rights violation tip, or know about a murder or some kind of serious injury that's occurred to somebody that you think needs attention and to be investigated, you can call area code 718-273-8708. That's area code 718-273-8708. And I just want to let you know that I will be continuing to try to get in touch with the district attorney at Fort Bend concerning Michael Blair's murder with 11 shots, even after he fell to the floor. And I will, as soon as I have more information, give people information about that. And following up on other things. For anybody who lives in New York, it's my understanding that the Justice Center is going to be the topic at the next Regional Advisory Committee meeting that NAMI members are being invited to. So maybe this might be a time for people to, you know, stand up and say, even though we want nothing to do with you, you shouldn't be doing any of this. And so I, you know, as hard as it is, but maybe we should have a presence there. And so I want to thank you all again for listening, for speaking out. Call in anytime, and I'm going to ask you to keep speaking out until I talk to you. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Have a good night.
Good night.